Who knows if it'll do much about inflation, but the Inflation Reduction Act could do a lot when it comes to climate change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, August 8th. Good to have you with us. The 755-page Inflation Reduction Act, which narrowly passed the Senate over the weekend, includes money for many of Democrats' biggest policy goals on health care, taxes, and climate change. The House still has to vote, and there could still be more changes to the bill. But even now, it's worth digging into the meat of the legislation. So let's start with the nearly $370 billion set aside for energy transition and climate change mitigation. Now, on the surface, that may sound like bad news for traditional fossil fuel companies, specifically big oil and gas, but Marketplace's Andy Euler reports it's a bit more nuanced than that.
All right, first the bad news if you own an oil company. This measure includes a required minimum tax rate and a new fee on methane emissions. But a lot of the larger oil companies already have tax bills above the minimum, and they've been actively trying to limit methane leakage anyway. David Calloway, editor of 24/7 Climate Insights, says that's basically where the bad news ends for big oil.
It's really a package that has a little something for everybody, and nobody can be really pissed off, and nobody can be entirely happy either. There was a lot of winners here and not a lot of losers.
He says oil companies win with expanded drilling opportunities on federal lands and potentially a new pipeline in West Virginia.
Most legislation of this type has carrots and sticks. This legislation mostly has carrots, not sticks.
Michael Weber is a professor of energy resources at the University of Texas at Austin. He says those carrots include tax credits for carbon capture, something that oil and gas companies will celebrate.
And for an industry that requires a lot of money to operate, that money is really useful.
The American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry's lobby group, said it's concerned this bill will discourage investment in U.S. oil and natural gas. But Morgan Bazillion at the Colorado School of Mines says it might actually help quash some of the worry investors are having when it comes to long-term oil and gas infrastructure, because, he says, this measure doesn't directly legislate a reduction in emissions.
That's why you don't see huge pushback from the oil and gas industry on this. This is, yes, a change in tone and good money going after an industrial policy of clean energy. That's all clear.
But it's not an attack on the use of fossil fuels. Bazillion says that's something this bill simply doesn't do. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks had a case of the Monday blahs. But we'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Andy Euler just said, the oil industry seems good with parts of the Inflation Reduction Act. But another powerful special interest here in Washington is decidedly not. That's the pharmaceutical industry. And that's because the legislation, as it's currently written, allows the government, for the first time, to directly negotiate the prices of some drugs on behalf of 48 million Medicare recipients. Marketplace's Matt Levin explains what those new powers could mean for the healthcare system.
Right now, drug companies negotiate separately with the private health plans that administer Medicare. That model helps keep drug prices 3 to 4 times higher in the U.S. than in the rest of the developed world, says Mariana Socal at Johns Hopkins. She says it's inefficient to have multiple entities negotiating simultaneously.
Versus having one entity negotiating for 40 million people at the same time, that's how Walmart gets lower prices, right? When you negotiate for a higher volume.
If a drug company doesn't come to the table, the bill would hit them with a pretty big tax penalty. But more importantly,
so it is on the best interest of the drug manufacturer to maintain their market share. And there's no larger market than the Medicare program.
Initially, Medicare's negotiating power would be limited to just 10 drugs that fit certain criteria. Basically, drugs that have been around a while, don't have cheaper substitutes, and that Medicare spends a lot on. Andrew Mulcahy is a health economist at RAND.
Drugs like Orencia for rheumatoid arthritis.
Or pricey cancer therapies. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the bill will save Medicare $288 billion over the next decade. And Mulcahy says those savings might spill over.
The arguments that the government would craft when they negotiate price might be pretty persuasive and help commercial insurers secure some lower prices on their end, too.
But Mulcahy says drug companies might also raise prices on non-Medicare plans to make up lost revenue. And Jenny Bryan at the pharmaceutical industry lobbying group Pharma argues the bill may have other unintended consequences.
The bill is going to really slow medical progress, we would argue, by putting a chill on research and innovation.
If the bill becomes law, the negotiated prices wouldn't take effect until 2026. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
So that big surprise of a jobs report last week, where the Bureau of Labor Statistics said the U.S. added 528,000 jobs in July, indicates that, for the most part, people who want a job can get one, or several. But many folks aren't taking on that second or third gig because they want to. It's because they have to. Lauren Kaori-Gurley is a staff writer covering labor for The Washington Post and says a big motivation for people taking on extra work is inflation.
Even though, like, hourly earnings are up for workers across the country, people are actually not making These wages increases are being wiped out by inflation. Since the pandemic happened, the number of people taking on second jobs has been steadily increasing. And so when I looked most recently into this, it actually turns out that more workers in the United States right now than ever before are working two full-time jobs. The reason why you would probably take on two extra jobs right now is because there are so many jobs, the job market is very strong, and because you're struggling from inflation.
I think it's worth sort of pulling out that detail because that data point was pretty wild in your story. More workers hold two full-time jobs than at any other point since BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, started collecting this data in 1994. I think most of us are used to people maybe having a full-time job and then a part-time job, but you're talking two full-time jobs just to keep up with rising prices.
Right. So that's over 70 hours a week, or 70 hours a week minimum, which means like you have your day job and then you're moonlighting full time with a second job. And, you know, a lot of these people are likely working close to minimum wage jobs. So the people I interviewed for the story said, like, just to be able to get to work to make money, I need to fill up my tank of gas. But once I fill up my tank of gas, that wipes out my entire earnings from my first job. So then I'm taking on a second job, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because one of the things that struck me is that many of the workers who can't cut back on gas, which is one of the areas where we've seen some inflation, even though gas prices are going down, many of these workers who can't cut back on gas because they don't have the option of remote work are also the folks who had to keep showing up in person for work throughout the pandemic. And it seems that that's really becoming a dividing line in this economy.
Yeah. So most people who have the ability to work from home are probably making a little bit more money, whereas as the people who were risking their lives and people like who, you know, run the who are bus drivers or people who are healthcare workers are really feeling the pinch right now.
Now that interest rates are up again, what do you think that's going to do for these folks and what does it mean for them?
That's a great question. You know, you may see this trend actually start to sort of die off a bit of people taking on extra jobs and really just see an increase in joblessness if we're headed towards a recession.
And that's the big if everyone's wondering about.
Right.
You wrote in your piece that while people taking on multiple jobs is typically a sign of a healthy job market, it's also a sign of increasing financial strain on people's pocketbooks. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So when the job market isn't a good place, there's an excess of jobs. But because inflation is also high, that means that people aren't, like, the money they have is going less far. So they have to spend more money to get the things that they would normally get, like food, housing, gas, etc. It makes a lot of sense that this sort of lines up with the data that we're seeing because there are jobs available and because they need that extra cash just to make ends meet.
Must be exhausting, though.
I mean, yeah. A couple of people I spoke to about this who had taken on second jobs over the past few months, you know, sort of broke down in tears on the phone, just like talking about especially people with kids, how difficult it is for them right now to make ends meet, to, you know, even know, like, am I going to be homeless next month? Rents are insanely high in certain cities like New York right now.
Lauren Kaori-Gurley covers labor for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up,
I would dream about bicycles, and they wouldn't be fun dreams about bicycles. They'd be like about a spoke.
I mean, who says dreams are supposed to make sense? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 29 points, about a tenth of a percent, to end at 32,832. The NASDAQ slid 13 points, again, one-tenth percent, to close at 12,644. The S&P 500 was off 5 points, wait for it, a tenth of a percent, to finish at 4140. Now, more on the Inflation Reduction Act. If passed, it would provide tax credits for people buying electric vehicles under $80,000. EV maker Tesla picked up 0.75%. Ford grew 0.3%. As for Medicare negotiating drug prices, like Matt was just telling us, drug maker Pfizer added 0.6%. Johnson & Johnson dipped 0.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.75%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. We've had record high temperatures in multiple parts of the country lately, along with drought. And with those conditions comes the higher risk of wildfires. And with climate change leading to more wildfires, more communities are trying to plan ahead to prevent them and to help people escape when they do come. Caroline Mims-Nice is a staff writer at The Atlantic and wrote about the need for better planning when it comes to wildfire evacuations. So I asked her, why are we so behind on this?
As one researcher put it to me, wildfires only really emerged as a major disaster in the last couple of years. Researchers are able to build simulations, but we don't historically have a ton of data. So it's sort of both that it's a new disaster and they're getting worse.
You know, because I think about the disasters where you sort of have planned evacuation routes, like for a hurricane or an earthquake, or I'm from Missouri, we had plans in places for tornadoes. Why is planning for a wildfire different?
The problem with fire is that it can spark really anywhere and grow to be any size and, depending on the wind, moved in any direction. Another thing is that when we're talking about evacuation time, we're actually talking about two different things. One is sort of the time it takes to alert someone. The other second component is transit time. And again, we don't have a ton of data. So we're sort of playing catch up.
That was one of the things that kind of shocked me about your piece, is that there isn't really a lot of real-world data around evacuations, and that the communities that are trying to plan for a potential wildfire evacuation have to rely on, what, simulations?
Yeah, I mean, simulations can be useful in general. Basically, they're able to take data from previous disasters and sort of understand worst case scenario, best case scenario. the real gap here is just there's no like playbook. As one expert put it to me is, people dying in building fires was a real problem. So we spent a lot of time saying, you know, if you're going to build a building, you really need to be able to make sure you can get all your people out. And this is how you do that. So developing those codes and standards, I think, is really important.
How do wildfire evacuations happen across different communities, especially when we're talking about different racial and ethnic groups, people in different economic groups?
Yeah, so there was a study out of the campfire, which basically burned the town of Paradise, California. And they found that people that were under 65, had a smartphone, and made more than $50,000 were able to get out much faster. And it's also important to think about this in terms of our most vulnerable populations, including people that might have disabilities. And we really do have to look at sort of the equity question when we're talking about this stuff.
With global warming, the areas that are at high risk for wildfire seem to be areas that maybe didn't think of themselves that way before. Has the increase in the severity and frequency and even the locations where wildfires are happening changing the way this conversation and the research around evacuations is happening?
I don't know that I have an exact answer for you. One interesting anecdote I heard from a source was a couple years ago, he was applying for some grants and had really wanted to study the large-scale evacuation of 100,000 people because of a wildfire. And people just laughed it off. People were like, that's a sci-fi scenario. And then within a couple years, there was a fire up in Canada that caused 80,000 people to be evacuated. You know, he said people are starting to take this field a lot more seriously. And I think it's probably important that we do in this new sort of fire age.
Fire age. Wow. Caroline Mims Nice, her piece on this is in The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you've probably heard us talk about on this show before, a lot of people have been leaving their jobs over the last couple of years. For some, that's because the pandemic made them realize, I don't like my life. I want to do something else. Pursue a calling, perhaps. But sometimes you don't really know what's next, just that you need something different. And you have to find your way there. One path, a 4,000-mile bike trip across the country. Marketplace's Mariel Segura has been talking to people who've found a calling in the pandemic and before, and she brings us this story from Portland, Maine.
In 2019, Leah Day had been a clinical social worker for 23 years. She was seeing 5 clients a day at her private practice in downtown Portland, and she barely had time to eat lunch. It was just one therapy session after another, and it was heavy. One of her clients would be getting a divorce.
And then 8 minutes later, someone come in and DHS was thinking about taking their children. Okay, we are here. I'm right there with you 100%.
Then Leah would run to catch a ferry home where her 16-year-old son would be waiting for dinner. Her husband, Twain, remembers those ferry rides. As they'd pull away from Portland, they could see the city lights twinkling across the harbor. It looked so pretty to him.
And to her, you know, she would say, all right, I see addiction. I see violence. I see drugs. I see neglected children. She would just see the city's layers of heartache.
And at almost 50, Leah was also getting restless. It's kind of her nature. She has this pivotal memory from high school of looking out her classroom window and noticing how green the grass was. She was like, I have to get out there.
And, you know, teachers already knew that I was a little bit squirrely. And I remember saying, oh, you know, Mr. Sessa, I need to go to the bathroom. And he was like, no, you do not. And I was like, no, I really do. He's like, you, Leah, come right back.
She went to the park. She just wanted to wander around. Leah always liked to be outside. And later, she led wilderness expeditions for Outward Bound. So maybe it's not surprising that she would have a long-standing dream of going across the country on a bike. And in 2019, when she needed a change, her son Oakley did too. He's a lot like her. Restless, always seeking adventure. He had this habit of running away from home. What if they did the bike trip together? She talked to her husband, and financially, it was a stretch.
I remember being so stressed out about it and feeling guilty.
Twain is a maritime lawyer, and he would be working. Plus, Leah would have insurance reimbursements from therapy trickling in. But they had three kids in college, lived paycheck to paycheck, and had lots of debt. He was supportive, though.
He's like, this is so important. It's important for you. It's important for Oakley. It'll work out.
Off they went. They carried what they needed on their backs. And at night, they camped out and slept at cheap or free hostels. On the trip, Leah couldn't wrap her head around the idea that she might do the same job for the next 20 years and then retire. It just felt narrow. Then it hit her. She didn't have to. They were biking at dawn through what she thinks was a high desert in Montana. And there she was, the horizon expanding for miles in every direction.
Just feeling like this world is so big and there's nothing saying that I have to follow, you know, the structure of this is how one lives a life.
They got home in late October 2019. All told, the trip cost $8,000. And she still didn't know what she wanted to do for work. She started substitute teaching. Then the pandemic happened, and she went back to doing therapy sessions by video chat from a bathroom in her house.
So I went from, like, the world to my bathroom, and that's where I counseled people for a year. And it was in that moment that I was like, I'm getting out of here.
In February 2021, she and Twain cooked up an idea. What if she opened a bike shop in Portland? She could rent bikes, repair them, and give tours of the Maine coast. She got a $69,000 loan from a nonprofit, and she and Twain put in $12,000 they'd saved up. She rented the space, bought a bunch of bikes and equipment, and got ready for opening day in May.
Pouring rain. And it poured rain like for the first week. And I'd hired two guys to come work here, and like one tour guide, one mechanic. And we were like, wow, there's nobody coming in. No one knows we exist.
But the customers started to trickle in. And that summer got busy. She was running tours, manning the shop, and writing a book called Changing Gears about the bike trip. By the fall, she was burning out.
I would dream about bicycles, and they wouldn't be fun dreams about bicycles. They'd be like about a spoke. There was not even a story. It would just be like, oh my gosh, I've dreamt about metal pieces. That is insane.
She eventually hired more people. Now she has 9 part-time employees. I visited Lighthouse Bikes in July. It's on a street corner in South Portland with big glass windows, rows of bikes, and a map on the back wall marked with each stop from the bike trip. When I meet Leah, her blonde gray hair is in a loose braid. She's wearing sandals, shorts, a t-shirt,
and a black bike shop apron because I was just changing very greasy, dirty flats before you came.
Customers stream in throughout the morning.
Hi.
One needs a new helmet. Another needs her bike chain fixed.
It is rusty, but what else is going on with it?
Leah says the work can be tiring, but it's a good tired, a physical tired. She's not emotionally exhausted like when she was a therapist. She's taking a salary of about $2,500 a month from the shop at this point, and she loves the work. To make this change, Leah had to take a risk. And she says she's probably more willing to do that because 12 years ago, she had eye cancer. She went through radiation, became partially blind in one eye, and was given a 20% chance of dying. So now her perspective is, you don't get out of life without bad things happening. But
if it's a guarantee, you might as well do what you want to do.
And right now, she wants to run the bike shop. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, summer travel is not getting any easier, and weekend storms in several parts of the country didn't help. More than 14,000 flights were delayed Saturday and Sunday, with hundreds of cancellations. More of the same today, although it is easing up a bit. So summer travel might be a great time to catch up on that summer reading list, since you may be waiting a little longer than planned. Here's your moment of economic context. One more detail on the Inflation Reduction Act on the way out. If passed as is, it allocates more funding to help folks enjoy the great outdoors. It calls for $500 million to hire more workers for the National Park Service and another $500 million for conservation, restoration, and protection of the lands under the Park Service's supervision. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.